Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. On this day, when new Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh is hearing his first arguments, we're examining whether this court represents how America is changing. Longtime journalist Ron Brownstein recently considered this and wrote on CNN.com, "Each of the Republican-appointed justices has demonstrated resistance to measures designed to protect or promote the interests of groups that often have been marginalized in American history." We're going to consider what that means for the court's decision-making and its relevance. What's the dynamic of the court between the justices? What it means as specific issues and cases head towards the court? And how Americans feel in trusting, in confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court. So I'm coming to you as we begin our conversation with our guests. If you have questions about how the court may tackle specific issues or a larger question about the court dynamics, we'd like to hear that question. This is not the show, because we've done a number of those shows, to talk about Brett Kavanaugh's character or the politics around his nomination and confirmation. We had those discussions. This is more of a conversation about how the court, now that it's set, now that there are nine justices again, how they will tackle specific issues and questions, larger questions about the court dynamics and public trust in the U.S. Supreme Court. I want to talk to our guests about that as well. And if you have a question about it, I welcome it. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Our guest today, Thomas Berg, is a law professor at the University of St. Thomas, and he's with me in the studio. And welcome. It's good to have you back here again.
Morning, Carrie.
Jason Zengerle is a writer for the New York Times Magazine. He recently wrote an article about the court titled "How the Trump Administration is Remaking the Courts," and he's with us today from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And Jason, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Thomas, by a number of measures, age, race, gender, this court really doesn't represent where America is today. I assume it's, if these justices are all still sitting or mostly still sitting in the next 10 to 15 years, it certainly won't be representative of America's demography. Does that matter?
Well, it can matter as far as sort of public trust in the court. I think In the end, what matters is what the court does and whether its decisions seem to reflect, on the one hand, a willingness to hear the claims of both sides and hear all voices and then issue a reasoned decision that people can accept. And the court has been able to do that in the past, even in cases when people have disagreed with its decisions. So I think it's important to have diversity on the court. But in the end, I think what the court does matters more. Now, that's a question, of course, of what the court is going to do.
Yeah, Jason, what the court does in some ways and the way the American public perceives it flows from who are these justices that are making the decisions and are they truly representative of what America is today? How do you connect the two?
Well, I think it's a question of who are the justices and are they representative, and then how they got on the court. Oh. And I think that is going to be a big issue, especially among Democrats. I think Democrats are going to come to view the current court as illegitimate. Because of the, and I think you're seeing that. I mean, I think you're seeing that now with the way certain Democratic politicians are talking. There's now like fairly serious discussion of court packing of, you know, if Democrats take back the White House, they take back the Senate, they should add justices to the court to offset what they view as these illegitimate justices. I think, you know, I think the court has been through periods in its past when members of various political parties have questioned its legitimacy, and I think we're about to enter into another period now like that.
What do you think about the idea of adding an extra justice or two to the court? There's no law, there's no constitutional amendment that says it has to be nine, right?
That's right, and it's been fewer in the past. And now the last attempt to do that seriously was by President Roosevelt in 1936. He had tried to add a justice for everyone who was over 70 years old. He claimed that the court couldn't handle its workload. And the Chief Justice wrote a letter to the Senate saying, no, we're handling our workload just fine. And FDR's attempt to add justices to the court failed on a kind of a bipartisan reaction against it. So I agree with Jason. These things are definitely out there. Representative Nadler has said if the Democrats take control of the House, the Judiciary Committee will do an investigation of Justice Kavanaugh. So this is going to continue. The problem with doing court packing is, I mean, you know, if the Democrats get in, they add seats to the court. The Republicans get the White House the next time and they add more seats. I mean, it's not really a stable kind of solution.
You know, what you're also reminding us of is, and I think this contributes to how the distrust that maybe more and more Americans view the court with is, I mean, there's political ideology behind some of these suggestions about adding more justices to the court and obviously who gets nominated. You simply can't take the politics out of it.
No, and it's
no.
Not...
Please go ahead.
Jason, you go ahead and then I'll ask Thomas for his thoughts and then we'll take some calls.
No, you've never been able to take the politics out of it. And, you know, that's kind of a reality of the court that I think people oftentimes try to overlook or ignore. But I think in this particular moment, the politics have never been more apparent and people are really, paying attention to that in a way that maybe they didn't before. They're becoming harder to ignore.
What do you think, Thomas?
Yes, I mean, I think that's right. But it was, of course, built into the system that politics would be a part of it. The president would nominate and the Senate would advise and consent. And there's no sort of limits put in there on what they're supposed to consider in doing that. The justices exercise a tremendous amount of power to strike down laws under the Constitution. And you have nine lawyers doing that. There's almost inevitably going to be some desire to have some political control over that institution.
Let's go to the phones to Joshua in Fargo, North Dakota. Hey, Joshua. Hi.
Hello, Kerry. How are you?
Good. What are you thinking about on this question?
Well, my thought doesn't quite relate to the current discussion, but I was thinking about that topic that you brought up about how the justices, whether or not they're representative of the American people. And I think that the reason or the court is established not to represent the American people, but to represent the Constitution and the American law. And so the people, when they look for representatives of themselves, whether it's demographically or ideologically, they're looking to their representatives in Congress, in the Senate, and to the president, because those are people that are popularly elected. Whereas the justices, as appointed, they're indirectly representative, but I think their main objective is to represent and defend the law as it's been written.
So Joshua, you're saying we don't, as Americans, we don't really expect the court to look and think like us. Is that right? I'm not sure that's true. Jason, what do you think?
I think different Americans look at it in different ways, and I think, you know, different political leaders look at it in different ways. I mean, I think one thing that was, you know, very apparent during the Obama years was an effort by the Obama White House to make the courts look more like America. I mean, that was the way they put it. You know, Obama wanted to have more female judges, wanted to have more judges of color on the bench. And in a lot of ways, that was more important to him than any kind of ideological litmus test. That's not been the case for Republican presidents. I think the ideological litmus test for them, certainly with President Trump, has been more important. So I think it's a question of, you know, the priorities of the person doing the nominating. But certainly, I think there are Americans who look at the court and want it to look like them.
And one of the things we know, Thomas, is the interpretation. I think Joshua called to say, we want them to interpret the Constitution and the law. And we know that that interpretation flows out of a lot of different things, including political ideology and life experience and your ideas coming up as a young lawyer and a judge. Sometimes the interpretation of the Constitution is unique to the beholder, right? And often, if you have a court that is not demographically reflective of where the country is, perhaps there's not as much trust in the interpretation.
Well, I think that's right, but there's a limit on it.
Okay.
I mean, in particular, I think Jason is right about the Obama administration and the lower federal courts. And you have regular appointments to the lower federal courts, and you can really affect the composition of it.
The administration's doing that now.
They're doing it in different ways, right? But the Supreme Court, it's a body of 9 justices. It's gonna be hard for that to keep up perfectly with the demographics of the nation, right? A seat might not come up for 30 years. So it's not an institution that is supposed to be popularly responsive in a really direct way. Now, one suggestion that's out there to try to fix the problem of the confirmation process is having term limits for justices. That would make the court more responsive. There would be more appointments by presidents. Each appointment would not have this be so fraught with this meaning of you're putting this person on the court for the next 35 years. I don't know whether it's a good solution, because it would mean there would also be more appointments to fight over, even though each one wasn't as fraught.
So you don't really have an opinion on that?
Well, I mean... It's also not going to happen. You'd have to amend the Constitution. But these are the ideas that are out there for trying to solve this, you know, kind of the mess that we're in.
Let me grab a call here from Sarah in Duluth. Hey, Sarah, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you. Well, first of all, of course Obama had an ideological test.
Yeah.
He didn't appoint any conservatives to the Supreme Court, did he?
So every president
does,
right?
Just wanted to make
right?
that correction.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. One quick comment and then a question for you. My quick comment is that I do trust the Supreme Court because they have in the past upheld laws that disagreed with their own personal political bent. The most obvious being, I think it was David Souter wrote the opinion on upholding Roe v. Wade, which he personally opposed, but the law is the law. And so he upheld the law, which is his job as a Supreme Court justice. My question is, would we even be having this conversation if Hillary Clinton had won and she had appointed 2 liberal judges? Would you think that that would be concerning? I don't think that you would, because that would lean more toward the way that you view the way that the country should be going. So that was my question to
okay.
you.
Okay. Sarah, good question. And Jason, I would say, even if Hillary Clinton was able to appoint, now President Trump has had 2 justices, mm-hmm. and if she had been able, if she was president and she had been able to choose 2 justices, I think there'd be the exact same conversation about how is she shaping the court for decades to come? Do you?
Well, it would be a different shape. I mean, for one thing, if Clinton had won, she would have been able to fill the Scalia seat, you know, either with Garland, presumably, or I think some people fantasize that she would swap out Garland for a younger and more liberal judge. That's entirely possible. If Clinton had won, Anthony Kennedy would not have resigned his seat, presumably. He would have waited for a Republican president.
I see.
You know, if, say, Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Stephen Breyer decided to step down, she would be replacing a more liberal justice with another justice. I mean, the thing that has made this so fraught is, you know, one, the lifetime appointment, which Professor Berg mentions, and 2, this is changing the balance of the court. That's I think what has made this so fraught, and I think that's one of the reasons we're having this discussion.
This
would have been a very different situation under a President Clinton.
The subtext of Sarah's question is, oh, it's Republicans, and so everybody's worried about that. I guess I'm asking you both, as any president gets more and more opportunities to appoint a justice, and we see the way that shapes the ideology of the court, it's a conversation about what that will mean. Thomas, do you want to weigh in?
Well, that's right. But I think what Sarah's call should caution us to remember is that the arguments that you make should be arguments that you're willing to apply to your side as well.
And how so?
So I don't mean to single out one particular article, but there was an article in The Atlantic last week about the legitimacy of the court going forward, written by their legal affairs editor. And he said, you know, for 50, 60 years, the Supreme Court has been a force for national unity in its decisions that it's rendered. And now that's not the case anymore. After this, it's all different. And I thought, and you know, among the cases that he gave as an example were Brown versus Board of Education, which in the end was a unifying decision that people support, but also Roe versus Wade. Now, Roe versus Wade, you can make many arguments for it and the importance of it for women, but it was not exactly a unifying decision. So I thought there were an awful lot of blinders in that article, and you know, there's a tendency for all of us to approach these questions with blinders. What we think is right, we tend to think of that as normal.
It's a conversation, if you've just tuned in, about what the now seating of Justice Kavanaugh, brand new in hearing arguments today at the U.S. Supreme Court, means for the future of the court, the dynamic between the justices. I want to talk to our guests about that. The cases that may come to the court and public trust in the U.S. Supreme Court, because we're seeing increasing numbers of Americans who are taking note of what they see as a politicized aspect of the court, and that is diminishing trust. Jason's done some writing on this. We're speaking to that as well. I'm asking you this morning if you have questions about how the court may tackle specific issues, or you have a larger question about the court dynamics and public trust and what the court decides. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @CarrieMPR to Bernie in South St. Paul. Hey, Bernie, hi.
Well, my feeling is very this, and it's like one of those things that's probably impossible. They should limit a presidential term of 4 years to just having one opportunity to make an appointee. If a second position becomes available during those 4 years, it should be done by the Senate majority of the other party from what the president wants.
Okay. So you're trying to get at, Bernie, too many justice appointments for one president, right?
That's right. I mean, it's just to keep the feeling of the American public that it's at least fair and looking at pitches fairly, there has to be a formula by which the Senate can't be loaded or else go to 4-year terms, one or the other.
Jason, I can't imagine it happening, but what do you think of the idea of it?
Exactly. I can't imagine it happening. I mean, but I do feel that it's important to remember that, you know, there was a long stretch where Democrats didn't actually appoint any Supreme Court justices. Republicans, you know, I think from Eisenhower through Bush 1 had appointed, I think, 7 straight justices or something. Clinton was the first one in, you know, 40 or 50 years. And we didn't have quite this sort of illegitimacy problem. I mean, obviously, there was a great backlash that led to the conservative legal movement to Roe v. Wade and concern about the court there. But there, I don't think we had the same sort of issues about illegitimacy of the court. I think it has to do with the nature of these confirmation battles and the nature of the judges being nominated for these positions as well. I think that it's not totally structural. I think things have changed in the way in which presidents are picking these nominees.
Thomas, I wanted to ask you on this question of the illegitimacy of the decisions, what it means when you have a democracy and faith in the highest decisions made by the court is eroding. What does that mean to the democracy, do you think?
Well, I want to check back a bit or power back a little bit on this. I'm thinking back to Bush versus Gore, mm-hmm. 2000. Supreme Court rules in favor of Bush, and at least at the time, it seemed like that was it was deciding the election.
Right.
The New Republic, Jason, I don't know if you were working for the New Republic at that time, but the New Republic had a cover story called, the title was Disgrace, the Supreme Court Commits Suicide.
I might have edited that story.
did you? I don't know if you wrote the headline. There was tremendous anger about Bush versus Gore, and a sense that the article said the court has destroyed its legitimacy in doing this. Within about 3 years, liberals were relying on the Supreme Court, and I hold this up as good as a way of checking the Bush administration's anti-terror actions. So I want to check back a little bit and say, I mean, the Supreme Court will continue to be there, and people will need to continue to take their cases mm-hmm. to the court, and the court will have a degree of legitimacy for that reason. We don't know what kind of issues might come up in the future that might actually cross ideological lines. Data privacy, some kinds of criminal procedure rights. We've already seen Justice Gorsuch in an immigration case vote in favor of due process rights for immigrants. It has happened in the past that people have said the court has no legitimacy, and it lasts until the next time the court has an issue that they would like to see go their way.
We have a question here from a caller on Bush v. Gore, so I'm glad you brought it up, to Anthony in Minnetonka. Hey, Anthony, what do you want to know about that?
Well, my reaction to that decision was exactly that it seemed delegitimizing. And I wonder why they couldn't come up with a 9-0 solution, even if that solution had been, we need to flip a coin because there's no other way to decide.
You mean you wanted to see unanimity on the court decision? The fact that it was divided was destructive.
Yes, at least to my eyes, it delegitimized them somewhat. And I heard the last point, which argues against that, but it seems like a court in that position, could have come up with a more nationally unifying solution to that problem.
What do you think of that, Jason?
I think that's what you would hope for. I think Professor Berg's point is excellent, that it's illegitimate until the next decision when suddenly you want to be considered legitimate. I think what will be really interesting going forward with this current court will be just efforts it sort of makes to establish its legitimacy, or maybe steer clear of cases or issues or rulings that would make people question its legitimacy. I think especially with Chief Justice Roberts, he'll be a very interesting person to watch going forward in terms of how he conducts himself, because he seems to be someone who's very sensitive to the institutional stature of the court and very much wants to protect it. And I think the court can behave in a way that protects that stature. And I think that Roberts would be someone who could help lead them in that direction. So I think that it's something I think some justices are mindful of, others maybe not so much. And I think it'll be a question of, who is mindful of it and who isn't.
Jason Zangerli is one of our guests here. If you've just gotten in on the conversation, he's a writer for the New York Times Magazine. He wrote a piece called How the Trump Administration is Remaking the Courts, with us from Chapel Hill, South, North Carolina. And Thomas Berg is in the studio with me, a professor at the University of St. Thomas. As we consider the new dynamic of the court, the issues headed that way, public trust, and historical perspective, which is really valuable. We're in what seems like a highly politicized, chaotic political environment, and the way we're seeing the court probably reflects a lot of the polarization. But it is good to take a step back and remember that we've been here before. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at @CarrieMPR, to Galen in Moorhead. Galen, do I have a note that you're a judge? Is that right?
Yes. Well, I'm a senior judge. I just retired about 6 months ago. I reached the age of 70, and this is a wonderful program. I've researched this problem of swing votes. The 5-4 swing vote nomination is the one that is the most cantankerous. And I've done a lot of research. I'm going to give a CLE to some young lawyers in Clay County in November. They don't know I'm going to talk about this concept, but my legal proposition based on what I've researched is when the Supreme Court undertakes to declare a statute or an act of Congress or an act of the president under Article II authority, they should be required to have a two-thirds majority in over to overrule that. In other words, there should be six instead of five. And I go back to the original Constitution in 1787, said nothing at all about this issue. In fact, many of the framers, Jefferson and Madison included, were very concerned about judicial review at all of the constitutionality of acts of Congress. And so 2 years later, in 1789, was the first Congress. Many of those people who were there, including Madison, had been part of the original founders. And guess how many justices they created in the first Judiciary Act of 1789?
Six. Okay.
And what does that tell you? It tells me that the only way the Supreme Court could ever declare an act of Congress unconstitutional was to have two-thirds.
The two-thirds four. Majority.
And there's so many other aspects of this that I could talk about that we obviously don't have time. For instance, Congress has no authority to create a law in the absence of consent by the president unless they have two-thirds of the Senate or and the Congress.
This is a pretty compelling argument. Hang with me for a minute. I want to ask our law professor what he thinks of this.
Well, yes, and there are states that have supermajority requirements for their courts striking down a law. The proposition here is that it's more controversial when the judges strike down a law than when they let it stand, because the, you know, if the law stands, the statute stands, the legislature could come along
right.
and fix it later.
Presumably, it's also representative. Your legislature made this decision about this law.
That's right. So have a supermajority going that way. Now, there are certainly decisions of the Supreme Court that have upheld laws, not struck them down, that have been highly controversial and made people really mad. Think, for example, about Korematsu, the Japanese internment, Japanese-American internment case. That's letting the government go forward and do something, rejecting a constitutional claim, and yet, you know, we look back on that as terrible. So I don't think it would deal with all of the controversy, but it's it would deal with the kind of the most aggressive thing the court does, which is strike down a law. And I think for some of the reasons that the judge says, there's a good argument that it would not require a constitutional amendment to have a supermajority.
Judge,
you could argue it both ways. But
Judge, what do you think about the conversation going on? Jason raised it earlier about adding justices to the U.S. Supreme Court.
First of all, that would it would require an act of Congress, and it wouldn't solve the fundamental problem of the swing vote. You could add one more justice and get 10. So then what do you have? You have six out of 10 would be required before there would be a majority. It'd be slightly more of a majority than five out of nine, but it would still be just a slight majority.
So you really want to just eliminate the idea of the swing vote because they're wielding so much power.
Well, only when the court undertakes to determine whether or not an act of Congress or a state statute or presidential conduct that he enters into under his prerogative under Article II, that's the only situation where the balance of power issue becomes paramount.
It's
the only situation where the Supreme Court is telling either the president or Congress with a bare majority, we're going to throw that law out on a 5-4 bare majority, notwithstanding the fact that Congress, you passed the law either with a two-thirds majority in the both House of Representatives or alternatively, you pass the law with a simple majority, but you got the consent of another branch of government, namely the president, to support it.
I feel like we're getting a glimpse of your continuing learning education lecture there, and I'm grateful for that, Judge. Thank you for the call.
Yeah. Jason, students, I hope the young lawyers in Clay County in November find it interesting.
I do, too. I think they will.
Thank you for allowing me to talk.
No, I love the fact that you called it. Jason, just some observation here before we get a look at the latest news.
I think it would be a politically popular idea right now,
especially
among Democrats, who I think are terrified of a bunch of 5-4 decisions going, you know, repealing laws that they support. So I could see that actually having some political popularity.
Thomas, how do you think this might change the dynamic of the court?
Well, it would probably push the justices to try to reach some kind of consensus, probably narrow decisions. You could strike down a law on narrower or broader grounds and get 6 votes for a narrow decision where you would only get 5 for the broader decision. It would change the dynamics on the court. I'm even though I think there's something to it, I'm not sanguine that either side would end up going for it, because each side has things that they do want struck down. Civil rights, protections against discriminatory laws on the liberal side, and conservatives want the courts to play a role in checking economic regulation and so on. So, I wouldn't hold my breath for this to happen either.
Conversation here about the U.S. Supreme Court now that Judge Kavanaugh has taken his seat on the court. Jason, I read your piece that published how the Trump administration is remaking the courts. And I pulled out something you were writing about how the philosophy of the Federalist Society has changed. And this is this conservative group of lawyers and judges, Kavanaugh, and I think, was Gorsuch a member of it? He was, wasn't he?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You say that for a long time, quote, the dominant philosophical emphasis was on judicial restraint, the idea that judges shouldn't overrule majority-passed, democratically enacted laws. I mean, it kind of goes to what our judge was calling to talk about. You're also indicating in the piece that that has changed. Why?
I think, you know, it was a sort of a gradual evolution in the academy. I think you had some conservative legal thinkers who wanted to stake out a more aggressive stance, people like Randy Barnett at Georgetown. But I think the real turning point in terms of the larger movement and the political aspect of it came with the Obamacare decision and Justice Roberts' decision to uphold Obamacare. I think that was a real wake-up call, I think, for some people in the conservative legal movement, that you had a Supreme Court that seemed to be a conservative majority. There were a number of Republican appointed judges, and they couldn't pull the trigger on repealing this law that conservatives felt was unconstitutional because they were too deferential. And I think that that led to kind of a reevaluation of how they should vet potential justices and what their thoughts are on being aggressive. I think the term they use now is judicial engagement rather than judicial restraint. But I think justices like Gorsuch and now like Kavanaugh, I think, will be less reticent to repeal laws in a way that maybe Roberts would be more so.
Thomas, this goes to something we were talking about off air, which is what happens when some of these other issues are headed to the court today and we have this evolving philosophy from the Federalist Society. You mentioned abortion, immigration, some of the other issues. How does that apply to how this court might handle some of those cases?
Well, in the area of abortion, you've still got, I think, the sort of what I think Jason might call the older kind of conservative judicial position, which is that the Constitution says nothing about abortion, and indeed it doesn't in any explicit way. And so that Roe versus Wade was an assertion of judicial power and overreach. The court should be more humble. That's in some tension with what he's described, mm-hmm. the kind of more libertarian, newer thinking in the Federalist Society. And so then it comes down to, well, you know what? If you are going to be a bit more active as a judge and strike down more laws, the question is, which areas are you going to do that in? And we have a disagreement, certainly on the court, between the more liberal justices who would focus their invalidation on discriminatory laws, criminal procedure, impositions on criminal defendants, and the more conservative justices who seem more willing, at least a couple of them might be more willing to take on economic regulation and administrative regulation in the name of a more conservative view. So, you know, the judge's suggestion to have a supermajority was a reflection of the older judicial restraint position, and occasionally it's attractive to liberals when they see the court going the other way. But liberals, I think that often end up coming back to relying on the court as a counter-majoritarian means of, you know, protecting minority rights.
Jason, are there specific issues where, as you were researching this change of perspective in the Federalist Society, that you think are ripe for, you know, seeing that emerge in these new justices? Yeah.
Oh, I think anything having to do with government regulation of economics and business, I think, will be an area. It was interesting during both the Kavanaugh and the Gorsuch hearings before the first round of the Kavanaugh hearings, not the second, but there was a lot of attention paid by liberal activist Democratic senators to abortion, social issues like that. And I think that, you know, the conservative justices and the nominees tend to try to hide the ball there a little bit. They, you know, they talk about respecting precedent. They don't have opinions. But when it comes to questions of economic regulation, business regulation, they're quite explicit in terms of wanting to, you know, go to war with the administrative state, or at least rein in the administrative state. And I think that's an area where I think you'll see some movement. I think that's an area where there could be a number of 5-4 decisions in the conservatives' favor.
Call here from Bill in Roseville, Minnesota. Hi, Bill. Thanks for waiting.
Well, Carrie, I've been reading where part of the problem with the Supreme Court and why it's lost so much respect is the weakness of Congress. They just aren't willing to do their job, so they've dumped a lot of social issues onto the Supreme Court that they were never meant to deal with. So that's why they have such bad approval ratings. And Congress is just very, very weak, you know.
Jason, is there something to that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, well, Congress has become, you know, it's not really a very effectively functioning legislative body at this point. And, you know, it's not so much that it's weak as it's gridlocked and it can't get anything done. And increasingly, all of our political disputes, which, you know, you would hope would be settled at the ballot box, are now being resolved in the courts. And I think that's something else that contributes to the polarized view of the courts these days.
Yeah, I have to say, we mentioned immigration a minute ago. That's a prime example of that, right? How long has Congress been trying to pass some kind of immigration reform? And now we've got these issues that are flowing out of Trump policy headed for the court. Can you think of another issue, Thomas, where Congress has basically not done anything to reform it or work on it, and it heads to the court? You're looking at me with skepticism.
Well, I think that definitely happens. Let me raise an issue that might seem a little bit obscure to people, but I'll try to explain why I imagine could be really one of the most important cases. There aren't a lot of obviously controversial cases on the docket right now, but there is a case that actually has to do with sex offender registration. And the question is, who decides whether somebody is a sex offender, if they have to register when they were convicted before the effective date of the federal statute that requires registering? And Congress did not address what to do with those people. It punted on it, and it punted it to the Attorney General. So the question here involves something that constitutional lawyers call the delegation doctrine or the non-delegation doctrine, which says Congress can't just punt the ball completely to the administrative agencies. You have to set up some kind of a standard, which it basically didn't do here. Congress does that a lot. in the administrative state, partly because issues are really hard to resolve and partly because Congress doesn't want to take the heat for it. So this is a case that's a kind of a civil rights case about sex offenders. But the implications are much broader. If the court says Congress has to start giving more of a detailed standard to guide agencies, that could have effects across a whole range of regulations.
And if they're gridlocked now, can you imagine what comes out of that?
Right. Less legislation.
And also, probably. And, you know, in addition to that, I mean, I think there, you know, the counter side to that is, do you really want Congress setting these – how into the weeds do you want Congress to go? I mean, I think, you know, the flip side of this is they give broad instructions and then you allow the experts at the agencies to kind of apply them in the way they see fit. And I think there are, you know, there are instances like the one Christopher just mentions where that the instructions are too broad, presumably. But there are other times where I think you don't want Congress necessarily – you know, dictating every minor point. You really do want to give a little deference to the agencies in terms of how they apply the law.
And this is an issue on which, to follow up on Jason's point, Justice Scalia and Justice Gorsuch disagreed. Scalia was much more deferential to administrative agencies and rejected this idea that Congress has to speak more clearly, whereas Gorsuch is more willing to overturn Congress on that.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you both about judicial temperament because this has come up. This comes up fairly often, but it really came up with emphasis in the second go-round of the Kavanaugh hearings. And Noah Feldman wrote this column for Bloomberg on judicial temperament, and he reminded us that the court is no stranger to what he calls hot-headed justices. And so here's what he writes in the piece. Collectively and individually, Justices Hugo Black, Robert Jackson, William O. Douglas, and Felix Frankfurter were nasty, vindictive, backbiting, ambitious, and partisan. A contemporary observer referred to the court on which they sat as nine scorpions in a bottle. Thomas, what does that tell us about what we should understand about judicial temperament? Because in the end, the country survived them too. What should we understand about this, especially since it came up in this second confirmation hearing?
The temperament and issues about temperament cut across ideological lines, too. Black and Frankfurter hated each other in part because they disagreed ideologically about how to approach cases. But more recently, you've had Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg being great friends. And on the other hand, I think my sense was that Justice Scalia and Justice O'Connor, for example, just didn't sort of hit it off personally. They didn't disagree as much on issues as Scalia and Ginsburg did. So it helps a lot. The current court has a lot of, I think, fairly good personalities on it in terms of working with each other.
Justice Kagan is
famous
then.
as ability to work across the aisle, and same with Roberts. With Brett Kavanaugh, we'll see how he turns out. He obviously had a moment, clearly, of lack of temperament, but he has already signaled that he wants to be, as he puts it, a member of a team of nine and bring stability and unity to the court. So
he's
time will tell.
He's also someone that's known to the court. I mean, I think that's actually an important point. He obviously did have this moment at the hearings, but at the same time, people who've known him for a long time said that was, you know, they'd never seen that side of him before. It was very out of character. And the people, you know, some of the justices on the court have known him for a long time. I mean, he sat on the D.C. Circuit. His clerks clerked for them. I believe when Kagan was dean of the Harvard Law School, she was the one who brought him to teach at Harvard. So he's someone who already has relationships with some of these justices on both sides. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think last night all eight justices attended his swearing in at the White House, which itself was kind of an unusual event, but I thought it was notable that every justice was there. And I also believe that Kagan and Ginsburg went to his smaller swearing in as well. So a lot of the, you know, speculation about interpersonal dynamics and whether he's going to be too hot-headed for the court. It seems like already there's been some cooling off on that front.
A call here from Todd in Ramsey. Hi, Todd. What are you thinking about?
Hi, Carrie. I've been listening with interest in the conversation, but as it goes on, I keep thinking to myself that so much seems to be fanciful speculation when you have the last two appointments to the Supreme Court being made by a president who can't even receive the majority of the popular vote, which in effect doesn't reflect the will of the people. And then when you have a president who twice received the majority of the popular vote, his appointment to the Supreme Court is turned away by Congress. It doesn't seem to be following.
This is the Merrick Garland. Yeah.
Yes.
And Jason, I mean, it's that has stuck in the craw of Democrats and Democratic voters and Democratic members of Congress. And it's for now, it's just something they really have to live with.
Yeah, it's some. I mean, unless they're gonna, you know, add justices to the court, it's luck of the draw. I mean, obviously McConnell kept the seat open after Scalia died, but if Scalia had passed away a couple years earlier when Democrats had a majority in the Senate, they would have been able to fill the seat. It's a question of the calendar and who actually has the votes in the Senate. And who has the votes in the Senate is that's a democratically elected decision. So it's just sort of how things shake out.
Yeah, the Merrick Garland, you could argue the Merrick Garland issue again. I do want to sort of talk about the Electoral College point. I mean, it is true that he did not receive the majority of the popular vote.
President Trump, we're talking about.
Vote. That's right. But that's the system, right?
Right?
I mean, you might as well say that the Supreme Court is undemocratic because it's only 9 lawyers. So why do they get to decide anything? We're not a pure democracy. We have a mixed constitutional system. And the Electoral College reflects some good and some bad policies about having equal representation of each of the states. And there's some bad history along with that. But it's also got reasons for it. And it's the system we're under.
I think Democrats will be less likely to pick at the scab about, you know, the Electoral College than they will the Garland stalemate. Because that was so unprecedented. I mean, and you know, whatever tradition McConnell says he was following, that was just a pure power politics play. And I think what will be really bad for the court is if in 2 years, a vacancy opens up during the presidential election and the Republicans still hold the Senate. And McConnell, who has now added a codicil to this tradition he was upholding about how it's if the Senate is controlled by a party that is different from the White House, that's when you don't confirm a justice during an election year. But now if the Senate is Republican in 2020 and Trump is president and a vacancy opens up, I think Republicans in the Senate will go ahead and try to confirm that justice, and
so,
then that will make the Kavanaugh thing look like nothing at all. That would be a real,
wow,
real conflict.
Wow. So I didn't know this, that McConnell's theory of this is, well, this is how it will be from now on, that if the party does not control the Senate that is in the White House, we don't vote on what?
McConnell's theory on this is basically he's just changing the rules to justify his decision.
Okay,
that's what his theory.
I mean, there's nothing real to that. It's just justification for the political move that he made.
Yes, I think that's the way I interpret it.
I mean, you might have defended the Garland move on the ground that Joe Biden, when he was chair of the Judiciary Committee back in the 1990s, suggested that a Republican president should not send up a nominee in the year before an election. He didn't get a chance to do anything about it, but you might defend the Garland point on that. But Jason is right. McConnell has what people might call an evolving tradition here that works for whatever would work in the situation.
Hey, thank you both. Thomas, good to have you in the studio again. Thanks much.
Thanks.
Jason, thank you. Good to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
And Jason Zengerle's piece is How the Trump Administration is Remaking the Courts. If you got in into the middle of the conversation, you can find it on the podcast. Search NPR News with Kerry Miller wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.